This is Monday, August 2nd, 2004, a second lecture at the Freiburg New Church Assembly, and this is actually the second lecture of the 2004 season. My name is Lee Wolfenden, and my topic this morning is the Hebrew Table of Nations. What we're going to look at this morning is this hour is the world according to the ancient Hebrews. And I'm indebted to Becky Finney, who can't be here because she's babysitting the kids, but she's the one who drew this beautiful map here far better than I could have, and that means you don't have to squint at a little tiny map that I'm holding up. For those of you who may be listening to this from some other location, through the wonders of our recording technology, you might want to find yourself a map of the part of the world where Asia and Europe and Africa all intersect, including the Mediterranean Sea, the Arabian Peninsula, over to the Caspian Sea. And if you have a map with you, you'll have an easier time understanding what I'm going to be saying. The ancient Hebrews did not know of the world as we know it. They didn't know that the world was a huge globe. They had no idea that there were lands beyond at least those three continents. They certainly didn't know about North and South America. And what you see here on the map is essentially the extent of their awareness of the world. They may perhaps have gotten some dim inklings of lands and peoples beyond this region, but basically this was the world that they knew, and this was also probably in the earliest millennia the only part of the world where there were anything that we might call highly developed civilizations. And those civilizations tended to fan out and become less developed as you move away from the Fertile Crescent. Fertile Crescent is really just a small part of this map, but it is the focal point, running from present-day Iraq up the Tigris and Euphrates River and then over into present-day Palestine. This is where the greatest, and then down into Egypt, of course, this was where the highest level of civilization was, and the farther away that you get from that region, the more primitive the people were. And it's even been identified as these people were in the Bronze Age, these people were still in the Stone Age. So what we have here is a map that spreads out from the center and the cradle of civilization, and it's all that the Hebrews knew. So if you're reading in the Old Testament and you hear some geographical term, you can be fairly well assured that it's contained within this map. So this is the world in which the ancient Hebrews lived. Now, by the time of the New Testament, it had been considerably developed up into this region, but still within the then-known world. And this was their world. And so all of their conceptions were developed within this sphere. And all of the events, of course, in the Bible take place within this sphere. Now, before we get to the chapter that we're going to speak of primarily today, which is Genesis chapter 10, I just want to give you a whirlwind tour of what has come before. And as a preface to this, just to remind you that those first 11 or so chapters of the Bible, from our perspective, from a Swedenborgian perspective, were never even intended by their original writers to be taken literally. The original writers, according to Swedenborg, were quite well aware that they were writing in symbolic, or what we would call correspondential language. They had no thought that the world was actually created in 6 days. They weren't interested in that. They were interested in the spiritual creation of human being. And we will get to that some later, not about the creation story specifically, but we will talk about some of the spiritual meanings here later. However, these first 11 chapters were never intended to be taken literally, but something interesting happens as we get to chapter 10 and 11, and that is it starts shading into what we might call real history. And that's you could think of chapter 10 as one of the most boring chapters in the Bible, but when you realize what's taking place there and how the whole background is being set for the entire biblical story, it becomes a little more interesting. So what has happened up to chapter 10? In Genesis chapter 1, of course, we have the creation story, although it could really be called the first creation story. And it actually goes over a little bit into chapter 2, the first three verses of chapter 2. They should have been put in chapter 1. I don't know what they were thinking about when they put them in chapter 2. But they put them in chapter 2, so we got to live with it. Because the rest of chapter 2 is what you could call the second creation story. If you compare the two, they don't tell the same story. Things get created in a different order. So we really have two creation stories. We have the first one, the familiar 6 days of creation and the seventh day of rest, and then we have humankind being created essentially first and all the other things being created afterwards. Completely different order. So we have, you can take your pick, which creation story do you like? There's two of them there for your reading pleasure. By the time we get to chapter 3, things are already starting to go downhill. We have the fall of humankind, the eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And this, by the way, considering it geographically, is all taking place down here in Shinar or Babylonia. That's where, if you look at a map made by people who think that this happened literally, that's where they're going to put the probable site of the Garden of Eden, right over here in present-day southern Iraq. Then, after the fall of humankind, we have the first murder in the Bible in chapter 4, the story of Cain and Abel. So we're really going downhill fast. And chapter 5 tells the whole story of how it just gets worse and worse until we finally get to the flood. And the flood is one of the first really extended stories in the Bible. It takes place over 4 chapters, chapters 6 through 9. And it really tells the story very extensively for the first time in the Bible. There are later extensive stories, one of the longest being the Joseph series, but here we really get into the storytelling as if it were human beings really doing things. But of course, we believe that it's all symbolic. However, these chapters 6 to 9 are showing the transition between the earlier state and the later one. And so many times, both in human life and in physics, the interesting times are the transitions. When things are going along just fine, you may get one verse that's covering 300 years, and they live, you know, happily ever after. But the times that are interesting are the times when things are changing. And the story of the flood is this really the story of the final changeover from what Swedenborg calls the most ancient church, or the very earliest religious era, the golden age in mythology, the heart-centered, very spontaneous early human life, into a more intellectual age, the Silver Age, the time when writing and mathematics and all of these different wonderful things that we think of as human intellectual culture were being developed. So we're moving from the early, almost instinctual age of humankind, when the heart ruled and we were ruled from within, to the time when the human intellect began to take over and become primary. And this is where we get in the ark, for example. Before, everything was one. Notice in the ark there are rooms. Everything's divided up, just the way the human mind likes to divide things into distinct categories as if they're really separate. So we're moving into a more intellectual age, into the Silver Era, and this is just when we're trying to make order out of our world. Look at a little child. They, in a sense, are trying to make order, but really they're just trying to get oriented and get the most basic skills for human life. But there comes a time when young children start to try to think and figure out what's going on around them. My boys are certainly doing that. They want to understand and figure things out, especially if it's the model they're putting together and it's not working the way it's supposed to. And so it's a more intellectual time. And this is what we're moving into. And it's just at that point that we have this chapter that categorizes all of humanity. And that's what's fascinating about chapter 10. You can read it as just a list of names, but this was an early attempt to categorize all of humanity, figure out where everybody fit in and where we fit in the whole world. And this is something that we're doing as a young child moving into later childhood. We're trying to figure out where do I fit in and where does everybody else fit in. So the Hebrew Table of Nations was the early attempt to, and you're in a rather successful attempt, really, for many centuries, for millennia, in fact, to figure out how the world worked, what was the lay of the land, where does everybody fit in. And then just going a little bit after the story so we can put it in its context, after chapter 11 continues the genealogies, it also has the story of the Tower of Babel, And then with chapter 12, we have the call of Abram. And this is where there's a definite transition to what we might call real history. I suspect it's still a little bit embroidered history, but it's based on human beings that actually existed. Swedenborg puts it back a little bit earlier than that, back to Eber. He says Eber was the first real human being. I wouldn't particularly argue the point one way or the other, but Eber is where the name Hebrew comes from, and he's considered the earliest father of the Hebrew nation. But with chapter 12, we've moved decisively out of purely symbolic history and into what might be called real history. So that's the context of chapter 10, the chapter that we're going to spend our time, most of our time on, for the rest of this hour. The Hebrew Table of Nations, it's shown here in living color, and it's based upon the three divisions that are the sons of Noah. Now, these people each represented not just an individual human being, but a whole race or clan of human beings. And so when the writers of those early books talked about Noah, they were talking spiritually about those who survived with some sense of religion or spirituality intact. There were other people, and there are hints in the biblical story of people who weren't descended from Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and yet somehow survived the flood. The people who were in that ark and who spread from those were representing what might be called a sort of our religious world, people who we can conceive of and who have some level of religion or spirituality. And Shem, Ham, and Japheth each represent a different strain of that, a different derivation. And we'll go into the spiritual meanings a little more later on. But first, I want to read Genesis 10 to you and point out on the map what many of these names correspond to. If you look at the map, Becky has very helpfully given us the key. I didn't even ask her to do that. What a gal. And if you look at the colors, the orange is Japheth, which is actually the third listed person in the story. The green is Ham, and the yellow is Shem. And of course, the way you're used to hearing them is just the reverse, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And allotted to both Ham and Shem. Boy, is she good. There's a couple of them, interestingly enough, where both Shem and Ham have descendants with the same names. And they became nations, and we don't know who they were. Maybe they got together or something and decided to call themselves the same thing. One thing to understand in general, though, is these names, although they're presented as names of individuals, they are really names of whole clans or nations. And if you read in the Bible in one of the old translations, you'll have all these words that end in im, I am. That's sort of like saying ites, or sort of like saying Israelites. It's speaking of a nation, and so even in the biblical text, many of them are essentially identified. This isn't really an individual, this is a nation. Okay, so let's look at chapter 10. This is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, who themselves had sons after the flood. And then we get them, and the reason they're in this order is this is the order in which their genealogy is presented in the Bible. Why in the world don't they do Shem first when he would be normally considered the eldest? Well, they wanted to be able to continue the story from Shem. The Bible story tries to be continuous. And the main line of the story is going to go through Shem. So they leave you with Shem, and then they continue on with the story from there. So you first have the Japhethites listed. And the Japhethites are the Indo-European peoples. If you look at the map, you'll find that they tend to be up toward the northwest. These are these orange ones and to the north. These are the ones who spread over toward India, who spread up into Europe. And to continue that general organization, Ham is the African peoples. They're the ones that spread it down toward the southeast and also up into Canaan. Now, Canaan's an interesting case because archaeologically and anthropologically, the belief is that these people were actually Semitic. They were Shemites. But the Hebrews considered them to be Hamitic, to be Hamites. And so, and what you're going to deal with in the Bible is what the Hebrews thought, not what later archaeologists thought. So now Palestinians, for example, will consider themselves to be Semitic, And yet the Hebrews didn't consider them to be Semitic. They thought when they were taking over Canaan that they were taking over lands that were belonging to people that descended from Ham. And then finally, the Semitic peoples, they're the ones that primarily occupied the Fertile Crescent and also down into the Arabian Peninsula. The Arabian Peninsula, though, encompassed both Hamites and Shemites. So the sons of Japheth, Gomer. We have Gomer up here somewhere, way up here in what would be the southern parts of the Soviet Union. And we have Magog, Madai. That's an important one. This is the Medes. If you've heard of the Medes and the Persians, that's where they descended from. You find time after time all the peoples listed in the Bible, you find them listed in one way or another in this list. You have Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiraz. You'll see some of them, but not all. Here's Tubal. They're identified on the map. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Rephath, and Togarma. Ashkenaz is up here. You've probably heard of the Ashkenazis. Well, it goes all the way back to here. The sons of Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, and Kittim. These ones are, they didn't have a very clear conception of Europe in general. They had some sense of southern Europe. And Tarshish, they thought, may be here over in these islands to the west of Italy, or perhaps to the west of Italy, or perhaps over in Spain. So these were the island peoples that were quite at a distance. From these, the maritime people spread out into their territories by their clans within their nations, each with its own language. So this particular clan was considered to be the island peoples, the peoples who inhabited the Mediterranean. Then we have the Hamites, the sons of Ham, Cush. Cush is what we call today Ethiopia, down south of Egypt. Mitzrayim, that's the Hebrew word for Egypt. So Mitzrayim is Egypt. Then Put, and I think that's the same as here over toward Algeria, and Canaan. As I said earlier, they thought of the Canaanites as being Hamites. The sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah. Here's one of those ones that has both Ham and Shem have that name. Sabta, Rama, and Sabdica. The sons of Rama, Sheba, and Dedan. These are mostly people who ended out settling in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. Then we get just a little bit of story, almost, in the middle of this genealogy, or really not genealogy, but family tree. Cush was the father of Nimrod, who grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That is why it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. I always like that. They like repetition, just like little kids. The first centers of his kingdom were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Kalna, and Shinar. Here's this Shinar, same as Babylonia. All of these regions are there. And this, by the way, is where Abraham's people came from. So we're telling here the story of Abraham's origins. Even though we're in Ham, we're telling about the people who are surrounding him. From that land, he went to Assyria, where he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, and Rezin, which is between Nineveh and Calah. That is the great city. And it's fascinating that Assyria is said here to originate from Babylonia. That's spiritually significant, because Babylonia represents, in the bad sense, the love of dominion from the love of self, i.e. the heart-centered evil, whereas Assyria is the ascendancy of human reason, in a sense, that we believe that we're best because we're smartest and able to think better than others. And that is said to originate in Babylonia, to originate really in the heart, which rationalists don't like to think about, but it's a fascinating little vignette found just within that one little verse. Mitzrayim was father of the Luddites, the Anamites, the Lehabites, the Naphtuhites, the Pathrusites, the Casluhites. These are the ones in Hebrew that would all be ending in im. And it's very clear that it's talking not about individuals, but about nations. So even in the text itself, we find it shading back and forth between naming them as individuals and naming them as nations. The Casluhites, from whom the Philistines came. Those would have been people living in the southwestern part of Canaan. And they were some of the most difficult foes that the Israelites later faced. And Kaphtorites. Canaan was the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and there's a very famous city in Canaan named Sidon. And of the Hittites, these are not, I don't think, the Hittites that made the major empire that was up to the north. There are sons of Heth or Hittites that are mentioned within the land of Canaan, and they're a whole different people than the Hittite Empire, which was up in this general area. So these are not the ones that the archaeologists talk about, but if you hear of Hittites in the Bible, it's generally these Canaanites. The Hittites, the Jebusites, that's another important one because Jebus was the earlier name for Jerusalem. So the Jebusites are the earlier inhabitants of Jerusalem, which David displaced when he made Jerusalem his capital. The Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, they would have likely been people down toward the Sinai Peninsula here, and the Arvadites, the Zemarites, and the Hamathites. Some of these turn up later on when the Israelites are conquering the Holy Land, and these are all peoples that they had to conquer. Later, the Canaanites scattered, and the borders of Canaan reached from Sidon toward Gerar as far as Gaza, and then toward Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, and Zeboim. Those, at least the Sodom and Gomorrah, are familiar names, as far as Laisha. And that, of course, would be in the southern area. The Jordan and the Dead Sea doesn't show on this map, but it would have been in the southern part of the Dead Sea. So these are all the peoples who were inhabiting the land of Canaan before the Israelites came there. And that's perhaps one of the reasons why the text goes into so much detail on these descendants. And then finally, the Semites. Sons were also born to Shem, whose older brother, there's some question as to what exactly the Hebrew means, but it's usually interpreted as who was the older brother of Japheth, but some have said it means that Japheth was older than Shem. Well, that'd be kind of interesting. Shem was the ancestor of all the sons of Eber. So right at the beginning of the Shemites, it's saying this is where we came from. In other words, where the writers of this story came from. They came from the Shemites because they are all descendants of Eber. So these are the good guys. The sons of Shem, Elam, Asher. Asher is Assyria. Elam is farther over here to the east of Iraq, so it would likely be what we would today call Iran. Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. Aram is up here. The Paddan Aram is the area up at the upper end of the Euphrates and Tigris River. And this was the area where the Hebrews settled, where Abram and his family settled before they went to the Holy Land up in the area of Haran. Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram, the sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. I always like the sound of that for some reason. Arphaxad was the father of Shelah, and Shelah was the father of Eber. So now we're getting a little bit of genealogy down to Eber. Two sons were born to Eber. One was named Peleg because in his time the earth was divided. His brother's name was Joktan. We have Joktan here sort of centrally in the Arabian Peninsula. Probably not right in the center because that was desert, but the sort of northeast center area. Joktan was the father of Almodad, Sheleph, Hazarmaveth, Jerah, Hadaram, Uzal, Dikla, Obel, Abimiel, Sheba, there's a name that we know, down to the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, and famous mainly because of the Queen of Sheba coming up and visiting Solomon. Ophir, Havilah, and there's that Havilah again, listed both under Ham and Shem. Sheba and Havilah both are. Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. These are the sons of Joktan, and I got kind of excited when I first read these. I said, boy, I bet you there's 12, but there aren't. There's 13, so go figure. The region where they live stretched from Mesha toward Sephar. We don't know where those places are, but they're in the Arabian Peninsula in the eastern hill country. These are the sons of Shem by their clans and languages in their territories and nations. So each son gets a listing of his descendants, and then it ends with this sort of closer to bracket the sons. These are the sons of Shem by their clans and languages in their territories and nations. And then the whole chapter is brought to a close. These are the clans of Noah's sons, according to their lines of descent, within their nations. From these, the nations spread out over the earth after the flood. So they're saying, this is where everybody came from. This is our origins, and this is the origins of all of the people that we know of, that we have any contact with. So that's chapter 10. If you just read it on your own, it would likely not be considered a very interesting chapter, but I'm hoping that through all of this it will become much more interesting to you than it was before, because as I've said earlier, this oriented the Hebrew people within their world. This was their database, so to speak, of humanity. This was their conception. Okay, so we've looked at the literal meaning. Now let's take a look at the spiritual meaning. And I found the best succinct expression of the overall spiritual meaning of these clans not to be in this chapter, but in an earlier place in explaining Genesis chapter 9, verse 18, when Noah's sons are going out of the ark. The verse in question is, "And Noah's sons who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan." And this is kind of an interesting thing that there Canaan becomes almost a fourth with the other three. And Swedenborg interprets it as such. Along with Shem, Ham, and Japheth, he brings in Canaan as another distinct almost son, but it's actually a grandson. So this, what I'm going to read to you, is from Arcana Celestia 1062. In fact, I'm going to read that whole number because it really encapsulates the spiritual meanings here. That Shem means the internal church, Ham the corrupted church, Japheth the external church, is also clear from what follows. I'm going to read that one more time because that's critical and core. Shem means the internal church, Ham the corrupted church, Japheth the external church. Later on, Swedenborg expresses this in terms of forms of worship. So later, when he's going into greater detail in chapter 10, he calls Shem internal worship, Ham corrupted internal worship, and Japheth external worship corresponding to internal. But it's really saying the same thing. Shem is the internal, Ham is the corrupted internal, Canaan, which we'll get to in a minute, is actually external worship devoid of internal, so it's essentially corrupted external, and Japheth is external that comes from the internal. In other words, external that honors what would be the internal, even if it's not consciously known. So Swedenborg's, this is also clear from what follows, for the nature of each one is described. As with every other church, the ancient church included people who were internal, people who were internal but corrupted, and people who were external. So the original writers of these symbolic narratives were aware of the different natures of different religious people. They weren't talking about people who were not at all religious, not that there were too many of those in those days. They were talking about the spiritual nature of the spiritual world in which they lived, of the religious world in which they lived. Now he's going to give a little more on what these different things mean. What does it mean to be an internal person? Internal people are those who make charity or love, kindness, the chief thing of faith. Corrupted internal people are those who make faith devoid of charity the chief thing of faith. And external people are those who give little thought to the internal person but who nevertheless perform charitable works and reverently keep up the religious observances of the church. So let's look at each one of these a little bit more fully. Internal people are those who make charity the chief thing of faith. In other words, internal people are the ones who think that actually loving and serving your neighbor is important. That's the most important thing, that you have love in your heart for God and for the neighbor. It's the same thing as in the New Testament, which Swedenborg will mention very explicitly a little later on. Fascinating stuff here. These are the ones who recognize that real religion is about loving God and loving the neighbor and serving others through love. And they feel that love within themselves and express it through their actions. corrupted internal people are those who make faith devoid of charity the chief thing of faith. When I first read that, I said, why in particular? Why would that be called corrupted internal? Well, faith is an internal thing. Faith is something that you feel inside of your heart or mind. It's a thought, and everything that has to do with thinking and feeling is internal. So these are people who do have an inner life. They think about things. They consider things. They try to work out their religion. And yet, a corrupt internal person is, Swedenborg says, somebody who puts faith first, who thinks the most important thing is that I believe the right thing. And if I believe the right thing, it's less important whether I care about anybody else, whether I love anybody, and whether I do anything. The most important thing is to believe what's correct. And this is a theme not only in Swedenborg, but in human life. Swedenborg will go on to say that this is a very attractive way of believing. Wouldn't just about anybody rather say, well, if I just believe the right thing, that's all that matters. I don't actually have to do anything about it. That's a lot easier than being a Semite, saying, no, I can't just believe it. I actually have to love people. That's starting to get harder. I actually have to do something about it. That's harder. So this corrupted internal is very attractive. It says all you have to do is believe the right thing, and you're headed toward heaven. And we have that coming right out in our Christianity today with the doctrine of salvation by faith alone. What's important is that you believe in Jesus. And if you believe in Jesus, everything else is pretty much taken care of. Yeah, you might have to do a few things, but basically, once you express your faith in Jesus, you're home free. That's very attractive because it doesn't require a lot of effort on your part. You can believe something and be all right. And then we have the third group. External people are those who give little thought to the internal person, but who nevertheless perform charitable works and reverently keep up the religious observances of the church. These are people who are basically good, but they're not thinkers, nor are they heart people. They just are going to say to their minister or priest, you tell me what to do and I'm going to do it. I want to be a good Christian, so if you tell me what I'm supposed to do, I'm going to do it. So they are not really working out the ideas and thoughts. They're not trying to figure out their beliefs. They're not developing the heart, but they are working with the hands and doing what's good. And these are good people. They're just not thinkers, and they're not heart people. They're hands people, so to speak. So you can think in general of Shem being the heart people, Ham being the head people, and Japheth being the hand people, the doers. That would be a very concrete way of thinking of these three. And Swedenborg goes on to say, apart from these three kinds of people, no others exist who are to be called members of the spiritual church. And since they were all members of the church, they were referred to as those who went out of the ark. He says, there are no others that could be considered part of the church. Well, if you don't either love God or think about your faith or at least try to live it, what else is there that could be called religious? And there are people who are entirely outside of this who don't believe in God, who don't have any particular faith, and who aren't making any effort to be good to their neighbor. They're basically in it for themselves and for their possessions. And so there are people who are outside of this whole conception, and they do crop up in the Bible from here to here, from here to here and there. But of course, the Bible is primarily the story of our spiritual life. And anything that's outside of our spiritual life is only peripherally of interest to the Bible story. So he's saying all of these are part of the church, and if you don't have at least one of these attributes, you're not a part of the church. And those are the ones who are preserved in the ark. The ark was to preserve the spiritual life of humankind. Those in the ancient church, and now the ancient church, of course, is the time after the ark. Before the ark, you had the most ancient church, even though it was becoming corrupted up to the ark. After the ark, you have the ancient church. Those in the ancient church who were internal people, that is, who made charity the chief thing of faith, were called Shem. Those in it who are internal but corrupt, namely those who made faith devoid of charity the chief thing of faith, were in the ancient church called Ham, while those in the church who were external and gave little thought to the internal person, but who nevertheless performed charitable works and reverently kept up the religious observances of the church were named Japheth. He's just summarizing what he said before. The nature of each one of these is dealt with in what follows. I thought this was the paragraph where he made a fascinating little statement about the Japhethites, but it's not, and I don't want to spend time here trying to look it up. What he said was that the Japhethites, the Shemites, those who were an internal church, were very similar to Christianity as it was intended to be. They had the love of God within them, and they expressed it outwardly. And so the Shemites were really the center and the core. Okay, so there's the layout, and we don't have a lot more time here and still give you a chance to say anything back to me. So I want to just do a little bit more on what this means for us. There's two ways we can take this. One is we can classify all the people around us according to this system. We can say there's a person who's a really loving person, who really cares, who has God in his or her life and really cares about other and is expressing that in life. Those would be people who are the Shemites. We can also see people, you know, they know an awful lot. They can recite the canon of the church. They know the Ten Commandments. They can answer your religious questions, but they're really not very nice people. Very intellectually advanced, know all the teachings, but they don't really live them. These are the Hamites, the ones who think that it's how smart you are spiritually that's important. And then the Japhethites, you know, don't confuse me with all this religious stuff. Just tell me what to do, and I'll do it. And they can be very good workers in your church. But are they going to come to Bible study or doctrinal class? Probably not. They're not interested in that. What they're interested in is the church supper and the harvest fair and that sort of thing, and they're going to come and take part in it. So you can use this to classify in your own mind the people around you. And all of these people can be good. It's not necessarily bad to be an intellectual Christian, and Ham can have good meanings. There can be people who thinking just happens to be their thing, and you might find some of them on that infamous faculty of the theological school that would impart their knowledge for good purposes. So Ham doesn't have to be bad, and Japheth certainly doesn't have to be bad. I didn't mention much about Canaan, but I should at least bring in briefly that Canaan is those who think that the church is all about external ritual. You go to church, you listen to the sermons, you do your prayers several times a day, you do all of the pious things, and if you do that, then it doesn't matter what you do with the rest of your life. You've gone through the motions. Now you can go out and cheat people and steal and be nasty to people behind their back because you've gone through the motions of church. And I think we probably know a few of these people as well. So that's one way it could be used. But another way it can be used, and probably a more useful way for our spiritual life, is to consider that each of those is part of the lay of the land within us. We do have our heart-centered part that really wants to love God and love the neighbor and do what's right. But we also, and I think Swedenborgians may be particularly prone to this, we also have that part that says, you know, we really have much better teachings than all those other churches. That means we're better, and they're worse than we are. And I think that we, over the couple of centuries that we've been in existence, have been very prone to being Hamites, thinking that the important thing is that we have the writings, we have the teachings, the correct doctrine, and therefore we're better than others. We have that within ourselves, thinking, I know more than that person, therefore I'm more religious, and I'm going to have a higher place in heaven than they are. And there's also in us that part that wants to just, you know, all this religion stuff is too darn confusing. I just want to go out there and do good works. Why should I bother working on myself? The important thing is I go out and do good works for the poor. So we have these within ourselves, and it's a part of our lay of the land. And what this story is really telling us as it continues on through the line of Shem is that the true spiritual line within us is not Ham or Japheth, although they play supporting roles. The true spiritual line in us, what God is really wanting us to be and to do, is to have that love for God and for others and have that be the source of our spiritual life. So really, in the end, this is focused, I think, most usefully on our own life, saying, what is it that I am supposed to be emphasizing most in my life? And it's saying, Shem, the love of God and the love of others, something that Jesus said in the New Testament, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, love your neighbor as yourself. that is the real center and core. And if we get over into these others and think that's the important thing, we've gotten off track. So the line of true spirituality goes through Shem. True inner worship is loving God, loving the neighbor, and then putting that out into our actions, living from that early love, that inner love. And only this truly brings us forward on our spiritual journey, and that's why the story is continued through the descendants of Shem. Well, I think I've probably said enough. I haven't given you very much time, but if there are any questions or comments on this, I'd be happy to hear them and respond as needed. Yes, Debbie.
Covered it pretty well when you talked about, you know, what's right and what's wrong. I mean, I think one of the problems when you try to classify people and then with other people is that you start getting judging things, what's better, what's not.
Right.
And that was one of those things when I started hearing and started thinking about classifying and thinking, wow, I don't know if I want to start judging people as to where they are and where they're going. And I guess one of my questions is good to know this, but what should you talked about what we really want to do is love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and love others. And is that really all we need to do?
Well, if you do that, it would keep you busy. Let's put it that way. There'd be plenty to do. In response to what you were sort of asking earlier, rather than using the information to judge others, I think it might be helpful to think of using it to understand others, and that people come from different positions. So if you're dealing with a Japhethite, the doctrinal class is probably not what's really going to reach them. What you want to do is give them something to do in your church. And so if you use this as a means of understanding others and helping them to move forward where they are, I think it can be more useful than using it to judge others. As far as loving others and doing good, it's very clear that in order to truly do that, from other places in Swedenborg's writings and in the Bible, that in order to really do that, you also have to learn the teachings. You have to learn the commandments. You have to learn the teachings, because those become your guide to actually doing a good job of loving others. If all you have is love, 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 but you don't understand how to help others, you may help others in ways that drive them crazy and that really aren't helpful, because you haven't understood this person just isn't going to come to a doctrinal class. This person needs to be a coffee hour lady. And your understanding of that helps you to serve them better, to find and help them find a place where they can have their joy and have their service. Does that in some way answer what you had in mind? It's a big question, so we're not going to answer it in 2 minutes. Yes, George.
I was interested in your coming, winding up with the two great commandments, because they come up three times in the Gospels, and twice somebody asks Jesus, and he gives the answer. In Luke, Jesus asks the lawyer, the expert in the law, and he comes back with this answer. And
yes.
Jesus says, you're right.
Yes.
So there's a Shemite already there. This is not an unknown principle. But it also is followed by something I think that bears on Debbie's question. Then the man comes back, but who is my neighbor?
Yes.
So it's, you know, just feeling good towards everybody is not necessarily love. Then it gets down to the neighbor is the one who actually does.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. And Swedenborg uses that story as saying the neighbor is the good and true in the other. And he points to that very story, saying this is shown in the story of the man who fell among the robbers, and the one who helped him is identified as the neighbor. Which is not exactly the question, in a sense, that the asker asked, but it was the inner question that he was asking, who is my neighbor? Jesus was Jesus said, Jesus asked the question, who was a neighbor to the man who fell among the thieves? The one, and he didn't answer Samaritan, he answered the one who helped him. And so he turned it around somewhat, but he still gave the deeper answer, and that is the neighbor is what's good, and by derivation, what's true. That is the neighbor. Any more on that? Any other thoughts or questions in our remaining 2 minutes? If not, then you can have an extra 2 minutes. Thank you.